on Education and Workforce in the Oregon State Senate. We are going to take up the issue of community college for high school graduates in a moment. We have Governor Kitzhaber coming down here in a few minutes. First, a bit of housekeeping. We're going to formally adopt committee rules. They should be familiar to you by now, the second day of this special short session. And they are what we've had before with one change. So let me go into a work session to adopt committee rules. They are the rules we've worked under before, with the exception of the new one-hour notice, where amendments have to be on OLS for a minute. So, discussion. Motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the rules for the Senate Education and Workforce Development Committee.
Senator Kamel moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 4, 2014. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the rules are adopted.
You gotta roll now.
I don't know, but I'm hearing no. And now I'd like to open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1524. Administrator Donovan, could you give us a brief summary?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 1524 directs the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to examine a program that this committee has taken to calling the Oregon Promise Program. That program, or the Oregon Promise Initiative, we've had testimony on that during the interim committee hearings on September 17th and November 20th of this past year, and then on January 16th, just a couple weeks ago. And it would hope to extend 2 years, or the equivalent thereof, of free community college to any high school graduate of an Oregon high school. There is one amendment in front of the committee, the dash one amendments, and that amendment would insert some language into the bill that states that students who completed grade 12 in compliance with the requirements of ORS 339.035, which is commonly known as homeschooling requirements, so to include those students as well, that is also before the committee.
Okay, thank you. I think we all recognize that there is no longer a path from high school to the middle class without some sort of technical training or higher education. I have a few facts to throw out here while we're talking to the governor. The average cost of a community college credit is $85. If a student takes 15 credits, it costs $1,200 per term, or approximately $3,700 per school year. Therefore, 2 years of full-time education is somewhere north of $7,000. And in 2011-2012, there were 32,000 students who earned a high school diploma. So when we do back-of-the-envelope math on this, because it's so very difficult to calculate this, we are looking at somewhere between $100 and $200 million per biennium if these students all attended community college. And of course, it's impossible to say whether they would or wouldn't. Some students will still go on to four-year universities. Others still may not go to college. So it's hard to say. But the one figure that keeps popping up in my mind is the student debt figure is now over $1 trillion. That is now higher than the credit card debt in this country. So, I mean, knowing how my family is, it's mind-boggling when I think that of all the families out there who owe money on their credit cards, students owe more than that. And so that's what we're going for, and I think it makes sense for us to do a technical study on the logistics and feasibility of moving forward here on offering free community college to Oregon high school students. So with that, we will stay in recess for a moment or two until Governor Kitzhaber arrives.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Oh, wow. You know, I learned this in Channel 2. We've got it right down to the second. Welcome, Governor. We just queued you up.
Thank you.
We're talking about the need for community college or 2 years of education out of high school because the pathway's no longer there between high school and middle class.
Great.
Thanks for coming down and talking to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, John Kitzhaber, Governor of the State of Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to say a few words today about your efforts Mr. Chairman, to ensure affordability for those Oregon students that are seeking to continue their education in community college. I think we all know that rising tuition, rising fees, increased cost of living means that too few students today actually see post-secondary education as a realistic opportunity for themselves. And even for those who manage to actually enroll in a community college or a university, the high cost of these various elements means that some of them attend part-time, some of them drop out partway through, many of them accumulate staggering burdens of debt. And we know that college debt is crushing young Oregonians and young people around this nation with school debt totals doubling since 2007. So I think when we think about affordability, we need to think about this not just as a problem in terms of access, but also a challenge of being productive when you're actually enrolled. Students who take longer to graduate because of high costs, students who drop out halfway through because of high costs, reduces the return on the state's investment in post-secondary education. Instead, I think we need to encourage young people and try to convince them and show them that a college education is available, is affordable, and is absolutely within their reach. And if we get this right, I think we can unleash a tremendous amount of motivation within these young people, giving them the motivation to stay in school, to get a certificate, and to achieve that additional learning that can make the difference for them in terms of their economic success. So I'm very excited about the idea of the Oregon Promise, and I think that for me to add something useful here this morning, I'd like to suggest that it's an excellent idea, but it is not without its complexities and potential pitfalls. So what I'd like to do is just take a minute and suggest several guiding principles that we might use as you begin to develop the actual policy around this concept. The first one would be sustainability. I think that whatever this policy looks like, it needs to be adaptable to fluctuations in both politics and resources without eroding the core concept of affordability. A second is student success. It seems to me that we need to create a set of incentives for colleges not simply to enroll more students, but actually better serve the students they have and lean into actually seeing them complete their degrees within within the appropriate time period. I don't think this policy should be a substitute for other efforts that are already underway to help colleges not just serve more students, but actually to serve those students better. The third one is equity. I think the resources should be focused on a way that moves us towards 40-40-20 in an equitable fashion and should be prioritized along those principles and goals that the state has set. Fourth is local flexibility, which I think is very important. Community colleges, as you know, are independent political districts with a unique ability to match their offerings to local needs. And so I think that the Oregon Promise should seek to try to align itself with those local needs. The fifth is cost effectiveness. As the state continues to assume a greater responsibility in access and completion, we need to redouble our efforts to control institutional costs. So when we talk about a free 2 years of college, it should not be licensed to simply have a blank check for what the taxpayers and the state are actually willing to invest. The sixth one I think is very important. The modeling must account for the total cost to the student. Even with the steep tuition increases that we've seen over the last few years, Pell Grants and other forms of financial aid actually pay for most of the cost, the tuition cost, for many students at the lower income levels. So for a lot of students, it's actually lost income. And it's the cost of living that are larger issues. And I think we need to reflect that both in program design and also to answer critics who say these students need to have some skin in the game. Often they do because of lost income and because of just the cost of living that they have to balance. The next one is maximizing federal funds. Absent any changes in federal Pell Grant formulas, we could end up, if we're not careful, simply replacing federal dollars with state dollars. So I think as you design the program, we need to seek maximum federal flexibility so we don't leave those resources sitting on the table. And finally, is the issue of impact, by which I mean asking the question, can something else deliver the same or better outcomes? We need to compare the impact of this concept with similarly sized investments. So while I'm not a big fan of a high aid, high cost model, I think we need to ask ourselves, what would happen if we were to take the same amount of resources and put it into a refined Oregon Opportunity Grant program? So I really commend you for taking on this issue. It is incredibly important as we try to sort of rebuild the middle class in this state and in this country. I was struck by, and I think many were, the level of interest nationally was generated by the Pay It Forward study that you passed last year. And I think it's very, very clear to me that addressing the issue of post-secondary affordability can't be done incrementally. So whether it's Pay It Forward, whether it's the Treasurer's Oregon Opportunity Initiative, whether it's the Oregon Promise, I think we need to take very bold steps in the next 2 to 4 years to make an affordable college education within reach of every Oregon high school graduate.
Thank you. Thanks for acknowledging the Pell Grant limits and limitations, and we've identified that as a potential source of money, and we want to be smart about it. We don't want to leave money on the table, as it were. We may need a federal waiver there. I think you have some experience in getting federal waivers, so we may need to lean on you for some of those changes, but we'll be watching this process, and it's great to know we have a strong partner here. Any questions? Yeah. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. First, on federal waivers, I think, Governor, you have bumped your head against that wall several times. We've experienced that together. I guess I think this is an appropriate effort and an exploratory move we're doing here. I know Clackamas already has a program in place. Umpqua is considering a scholarship program, but theirs is based on a certain academic level achieved, which is an incentive for, you know, I guess, are you, you're willing to consider that there needs to be some incentive base so the kids know that if they work hard in high school, that this is an availability to them, not just simply a diploma? Is that something worth considering?
Yeah, I think it is. It's interesting. You know, my dad was served in Patton's Army in Europe, and when he came back, this was 1945, 1946, and you know, a grateful nation gave that whole generation a free college education, which was really one of the most remarkable social programs, I think, of the last century. It lifted up this whole generation of Americans who paid back those resources time and time again because of the, you know, the education and the earning power they could get. And that was a time when you didn't need a college degree or a certificate to get a good job, right? And today, when we all acknowledge that, we've created these barriers. So I think clearly creating both an incentive, but also the belief that if you do work hard, you actually are going to have an affordable college education, it should be a key element of the program.
Senator Roble.
Yeah, I, along that same line, at our high school, we had determined that we wanted to allow kids to take community college classes, and so we ended up having a fund so we could pay for tuition. And we came to the conclusion that the best way to do that was to reimburse. Because what we found is when we gave it to people, they didn't necessarily take it as seriously when they were in school. And if they came back and failed all their classes and we'd already paid it, everybody was out. No one had gained. And when we said, okay, we will pay for your tuition, but you are going to have to upfront the first tuition payment. And when you return a passing grade, you get your money. And then you can pay it forever. That changed the whole atmosphere of it, and people took it a lot more seriously and did it. And I think it was a learning experience for us to realize that you just have it there. Some people go out and do what you were saying. Right. They just go because they thought it was a really neat thing to do, but they didn't take it serious enough to finish it the way they should have. And I think it was a good experience for us. And the kids afterwards said, you know, it made it a lot more serious when I knew that I had to, if I wanted to get my money back, I better do something. And this, you know, one class is not a whole lot of money. And that we weren't talking about the whole tuition, but because when you pay a whole quarter, that's a different thing than the other one. And I've always thought maybe we should do is pay the first one and let them have that chance. But if you want your next, you're going to have to be reimbursed. So I've thought about this a lot and have thought there's got to be ways to incentivize working hard and doing the right thing to get the money, as opposed to just thinking it's a right that you have it because you want to go have a good time at the community college. And there's a lot of them that would do the right thing the whole way through. There's others that aren't willing to struggle through that first little bit, knowing that if I don't struggle, I'm not going to get it back. Makes you struggle a little harder. So I hope we can kind of have those real conversations. I appreciated your list, because I think those are all things we need to think about.
Mr. Chairman, I think the fact that you're having this conversation is, I think, very significant, and there may be a number of elements to it. We know, of course, that kids who earn college credits in high school are much more likely to go on. If you could get a full year under your belt, you've obviously reduced the cost of your college by 25%. We do have the issue of, it's not really double dipping, but the way our reimbursement formula goes, there's a competition between the high school and the community college, and that's something you might want to think about addressing as well.
That is one of the things, to try to get that demilitarized zone in there between 11 and 14.
Right.
Yep. The question is, Governor, thank you so much for coming
down. Thanks, sir.
Okay, Duncan Wise, President of the Oregon Business Council. Welcome. Thanks for coming down.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. It's really a pleasure to be before you this afternoon to speak to the bill. Again, I am a president of the Oregon Business Council. My name is Duncan Wise. I'm also a member of the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, and I'm really today speaking on behalf of the council. Since I'm just one member, we haven't taken a position as a heck at this point. Really commend you, as the governor just did, for presenting this bill, and I would really encourage this kind of a dialogue with the heck. I really want to thank this committee for the work you did last session on higher education, post-secondary education, and all the reforms that you passed. Last week, we heard from the president of the Lumina Foundation, Jimmy Marisotis, and he said, from his framing, you have now put in place the most logical, sensible structure for post-secondary governance in the country. And he reminded us that the country is now watching. Very much in play because of the work you did last session. So I cannot thank you enough for what you did. And one of the great benefits of the creation of the HEC is that a bill like this has a home. I saw Ben back there, Ben Cannon. You have an absolutely spectacular executive director at the HEC, and one of the roles that the HEC is to play is to review ideas that you present and come back with finished policy analysis for you to be able to think more deeply about the topics that you're presenting. So to me, this kind of a dialogue of asking the question is, you know, you're asking in 1524 about the idea of free tuition for high school graduates. Is that a logical path? How would we implement it? What are the trade-offs, as the governor suggested? You should expect high-quality response from the HEC when you put out a bill like this. And frankly, I would encourage you to, you know, throw more ideas out about what is it going to take to achieve our ambitious 40-40-20 goals, and really think hard about how to have this dialogue through the year, so by the time we come back to session, we have work that you're really comfortable with and would like to turn into actual legislation and implementation. So really commend you for the bill. Let me just try to frame this a little bit more broadly in the context of the 40-40-20 goal that we have for Oregon. Jamie Marisotis, he also took a look at the larger restructuring of education in Oregon under the Education Investment Board and spoke to that as well. And again, from his point of view, he said it's spot on. He said, and I just want to remind us what I think the strategy is, at least from my interpretation. 40-40-20 is about creating much greater expectations for student learning than we've ever done in the past, with the understanding that to achieve those goals, we have to rethink the education process itself. We will not achieve 40-40-20 without actually rethinking what goes on in the classroom and how we deliver education and the motivation of students to achieve advanced education. The vision in my mind on 40-40-20 is to say that every learner has the opportunity to at least achieve a high-quality high school diploma, but the expectation from nearly 80% is that they will go on and get some form of post-secondary education. Now, needless to say, that is not the case. That's not where we are today, and you cited the numbers, Senator, at the beginning. The graduating class, say 32,000 students that you mentioned, that reflects a dropout rate of over 10,000. In other words, there are probably 50,000 or so 18-year-olds, many who don't achieve the high school diploma in the first place. Of those 32,000, about 8,000 don't go on to any form of post-secondary education. So we have a huge gap of both high school achievement and then the interest in going on that is just far, the results are far from where we want to be with the 40-40-20 goal. As we think about 40-40-20, I think we need to distinguish between the full adult population and the pipeline, that is the students flowing through school today and entering adulthood. We have daunting challenges in both cases, but I would argue that if we don't get the pipeline right, if we don't design the system so that a first grader, a middle schooler, someone in the pipeline today sees a path to at least a two-year or four-year degree, we're not doing what we need to do in Oregon, and so we need to think about what that pathway looks like. To me, the pathway has two elements. First of all, we have to create the learning process that gives students a clear understanding and a sight to achieving the goal. And we need to, second, create a financial model that assures every student knows that if they pursue the pathway, they can go on to the next step. And my simple way of putting it would be, if you achieve the high school diploma in Oregon, and remember, our new high school diploma includes pretty advanced skills in reading, in writing, and in math. It's not a simple diploma anymore. This is a diploma that we've actually set with an aim to enable students to be ready for higher education. I would argue, if you achieve the Oregon diploma, we ought to be able to say to every student in Oregon, you will be able to go on and pursue an advanced degree. We have to be able to say that if we're serious about 40-40-20. What that means in terms of the financial model and whether everyone gets free tuition or whether it's need-based aid or some combination, I don't know the answer to that. But we have to be able to say, if you achieve the high school diploma, we are going to assure a middle schooler in a low-income neighborhood right now that you can go on and get a degree. I will tell you, I was just out in David Douglas yesterday talking to high school students, and there are plenty of high school students who don't believe that. They don't really think they can go. And if that is the attitude and that feeds back into the process, you aren't going to have motivated students to go on to college, and that's just the reality. So to me, that's just to achieve the goal in the pipeline, we have to make that commitment, and then that which sets up this conversation for Senate Bill 1524. So again, the governor did a beautiful job of laying out the issues. There are a lot of issues of how you implement anything like this. We have the issue of need-based aid versus institutional support. We've got to think about the implications of the program on incentives for keeping costs down in the community college system. We need to think, as Senator Robum's suggestion, is this a stipend for achievement, or is it upfront payment? A series of issues that are complicated, difficult, and that's why you have the HEC, and that's why you've got a great staff in the HEC that can sort some of these issues and bring back the work. I would argue right now the key is to put the issue in front of us and ask the question, how do we ensure that every student knows when they receive the diploma they can go on and achieve an advanced degree? And with that, I would be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Duncan. I should have pointed out that you're on the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and, prior to that, the State Board of Education.
Yes.
So this is in your wheelhouse. Can you talk for a moment about some of your members and the council? To what extent is there a problem of them looking to hire and not having the skill set out there?
Yes. Thank you, Senator. Yes. Just right now in Oregon, in a time where we still have high unemployment, there are many employers I talk to who have real trouble finding skilled workers, especially in what I call the middle 40, in the technical areas, technical degrees, manufacturing in particular. Spending my morning on that question, trying to what are the certificates, what kind of certificates do we need to help meet the needs of our manufacturing, and obviously in healthcare, many of you are aware of the shortages in healthcare. There are a lot of what we call middle-skill jobs, the middle 40, that really are critically important for the economy that we would fill by having more students complete what I would call the middle 40 degrees. So key priority. I would also point out that if you take a look at poverty in Oregon, where it resides, a lot of the poverty, the cohort where you see a great deal of poverty are in the young adult years, and the children, frankly, of those young adults. So what we see is the pathway from roughly age 13 to age 25 is not a very promising pathway for a lot of Oregonians right now, and it's not good for them. A lot of them are in poverty, and it's not good for the economy because a lot of employers are looking for skilled workforce that, if we had the right education match, we could fill. So I think it's just an extraordinary opportunity to, if we can figure this out, to improve the lives of Oregonians and build, rebuild our economy.
Senator Roblin?
No.
Any questions? Duncan Wise? Okay, sir. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Next up, we have Matthew Chobold of the Oregon Youth Development Agency, and we invited him up here after having some conversations with a population of young people that has grown so large that it has its own name now, the Idle Youth. And it sounds like a rock band, but it's not. It's a large number of kids that we'll hear more about that have no job, no skills. Matt, thanks for coming forward.
Thank you. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matthew Schaubold, and I'm a policy analyst with the Youth Development Council. So can we...
Warming up. It's snowing outside. It takes a little longer.
That's right.
Oh, it's not sticking. It's not that bad at all.
Well, up higher it might be.
I don't think so. Not enough, you know.
Yeah, not enough. It's got...
Two hours too late.
Yeah, that's... Maybe too late. How much for this? Yeah, I agree.
Have you ever seen Red Flag Days in January before?
Exactly.
All of us.
Can I get on it?
Yeah. We'll stand at ease for a minute and get an IT guy up here.
Yeah, sorry.
Council. And the Youth Development Council, as you all are aware, was a part of some of the education reforms, the development of the Early Learning Council, the Education Investment Board, and a piece of that was the Youth Development Council. And the Youth Development Council was tasked with really looking at youth that are experiencing barriers to learning, barriers to educational and career success, involvement in youth violence and crime. And one population that we're looking at is a population that we call opportunity youth. And and this is a term that's being used nationally. Historically, by different folks at different levels, they've been called disconnected youth, disengaged youth, idle youth is some of the terms with respect to the data that's tracked. But the conversation has been shifting to talk about them more in terms of the economic opportunity, if we can fully engage them in the education system and the labor force. So opportunity youth are youth that have been disconnected from both school and work, so ages 16 to 24, and they are not in school and not working. In Oregon, we estimate that one in every seven youth aged 16 to 24 is neither in school nor working. And this, again, it's a combination of chronic opportunity youth who have never had a secure attachment and underattached youth who are marginally attached from the age of 16 to 24. In total, it's about 66,500 based on population estimates within the census. And we know that the rate is almost double for Hispanic-Latino youth. It is double for African-American youth, and it disproportionately affects communities of color as well as low-income families. When you look at trying to put a economic cost on having these youth not in school and not working, thanks to a lot of longitudinal data tracking that is happening at the national level, the White House commissioned a report that was produced 2 years ago this month that applied an economic burden to having the youth not in school and not working.
Matt, can I just want to interrupt you right here if I could, because I think this is central to this policy change. We've got 66,500 people in Oregon that are not doing anything. And it's not like they're free to society. Mm-hmm. And it's that number times an immediate tax burden of $14,000 per year and related costs as we go up. So it's not as if we don't move forward on this that the bills don't keep coming. And as I think has been noted, 2 years of community college tuition is much cheaper than a lifetime of food stamps. So I don't want to steal your thunder here, but no. I think these two slides are kind of critical to this whole debate. Sorry. Yeah, no. Go ahead, Senator Robles.
I was going to say, it's not a lifetime. Community colleges are cheap with respect to a couple of 10 years of food stamps. I mean,
yeah.
You know, a lifetime, in a sense, is yeah. really, really expensive. But
yeah. even a few years.
Even if
yeah.
a few years, is community college is cheaper.
Chair, members of the committee. And so, yes, there's about a $14,000 immediate tax burden and about a $37,000 social burden in addition to lifetime burdens in both tax and social if these youth are not connected to school and then transitioning successfully to the labor force. On page 6 here, it's a breakdown. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but essentially what it has done is broken down both the fiscal burden and social burden based on the various costs. Some of it is lost tax revenue. Some of it is increased tax expenditures on crime, public safety, health, education, and pieces like that to arrive at the net fiscal and social burden per youth. If you apply the estimate of 66,500 youth in Oregon disconnected from both school and work, and you use the cost estimate built that was built based on the report commissioned by the White House, you'll see that there's over a $924 million direct fiscal burden for the state of Oregon, in net present value $2,011. And I would remind the committee that the report was produced 2 years ago, and there's a roll-up effect as youth that continue to be disconnected from school and work may stay disconnected, and others may enter that age 16 to 24 cohort. So there's a number of barriers or reasons why these youth disconnect from school and work. Some of it has to do with involvement in criminal activity, homelessness, teen pregnancy, family obligations. But one underlying theme that is present amongst all the youth in the National Youth Longitudinal Survey was that there's really disparities in the level of educational attainment. whereas 36% of the youth population nationwide has some sort of post-secondary associate's degree, credential, bachelor's degree, or higher degree. Only 1% of these opportunity youth have that education credential. If you look at the labor market demand for education over the past half century, we've really seen almost a reversal. And I know this is nothing new to the folks in this room or the members of the committee, where nearly three quarters of the jobs in the 1970s required only a high school degree or a high school level of education. And if you look at the numbers that are projected for 2020, you see almost a reversal. And that is that the majority of jobs will require at least some sort of post-secondary education, technical certification, associate's degree, bachelor's degree, and so on. If you look specifically at Oregon and the labor market demand for education for the year 2018, you'll see that the majority of the not only the growth, but as well as the jobs that are forecasted to exist in Oregon are going to require more than a high school degree and either a technical certification, some community college, an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, or a graduate degree. Nationwide, Oregon is ranked number five with respect to the labor market demand for education being some college. And that means that the majority of jobs and the percentage of jobs in Oregon that will require some college will be greater than most of the states in the United States. So the implications for opportunity youth are fairly evident. There's a misalignment between the skills that opportunity youth had, and you heard Duncan Wise speak to this, and again, you all are very well aware of this, but there's a misalignment between the skills that many of the opportunity youth have, the credentials that they have, the education that they have, and what the labor market demand is. And as you all, members of the committee, have mentioned, this is not something that will simply go away if we're not able to come up with some sort of mechanism to help support the educational attainment and skills development of these youth. The other issue that many opportunity youth face, which is why we're encouraged by this bill and the possibility of the findings of the group, is that opportunity youth are limited both in terms of their resources and their access to capital in order to fund post-secondary education. And so a bill like the one you have before you today, legislation to support this kind of approach not only supports the governor's 40-40-20 goals, but will help to support opportunity youth, again, those who are disproportionately from communities of color and low-income families, be able to access the kinds of technical certifications and degrees to be competitive in the labor market of the future. So with that, are there any questions?
Questions for Matt on our youth? Where do you do? It's more qualitative than quantitative on your statistical findings. It's, this group, opportunity youth, idle youth, however you want to categorize them, where do you find the line in the sand where it says, I would go to community college if I just can't afford the whole thing? At what point is it financial versus cultural?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, what I would say to that would be that if you look at some of the national data, and we are still in the process of examining what this means exactly for Oregon, but the trends do seem comparable, that with respect to opportunity youth, there's about a 50-50 split, where 50% are underattached. They've had They've had a marginal attachment to school. They've had a marginal attachment to the workforce, but they're having trouble transitioning between school and work or securing a stable foothold in the marketplace. And the other 50% are what is called chronic opportunity youth. And these are youth that have had no secure attachment since the age of 16. Sometimes there are family responsibilities. Sometimes there's an institutional residence. Sometimes there's struggles with homelessness. And those youth, while some definitely have, as focus groups and surveys have been conducted, would like to access post-secondary education, I do believe that it would be the under-attached and those with that marginal attachment where they would really utilize a program like this.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate your presentation.
Thank you.
Well done, sir. Peter Padilla, Oregon Christian Home Education Network.
Chairman House, members of the committee, Peter Padilla, representative of the OCHEN Network, the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network, and I'd like to just briefly state that OCHEN Network is neither in favor of this bill or opposes this bill. Basically, our position is that if the bill moves forward, that that it just seeks an equity. Heard the statement previous to the comment of all graduates. And so understanding that statement, just recognizing that the homeschool community would fit in and into that process. And so I think you've received the amendment and at our request, and that pretty much. The other thing that I guess we would just ask, if that moves forward, is that OCHEN Network may be a part of the process in developing how that works out as this process develops with this bill. And then I'd like to say that in the discussion about talking about incentives, I'm glad to see those kind of discussions being made. And that's really all I have to say. On a personal note, listening to the conversation, it's interesting. I'm a self-employed individual. Obviously, we've homeschooled. I have 7 sons, and that each have worked with me in my business. Some have gone on. Some are still at home being home educated and a part of the business. Just an observation is that seems to me that if we're waiting till age 16 to develop a work ethic, then we're waiting too long. Thank you. I guess any questions?
Questions. Thank you. Well, we do have the amendment to address your concern, and we thank Senator Knope for getting on it, getting it in on time, and there's certainly there was never any intent to exclude homeschool
Didn't think
kids
so.
From attending community sure. colleges. And appreciate you neither supporting nor opposing this, but if it goes forward, you want in on it, is what I heard you say.
We would like to be a part of the process so that it integrates, home educated graduates as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have no one else signed up here. I do note that Ben Cannon is here, and he's not signed up. Mr. Cannon, this is going to be your baby for 8 or 9 or 10 months, so if you wanted to weigh in, now's the time. But
uh, Senator Hess, members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I have very little to add upon the words that have preceded. I think a good illustration of some of the possibilities inherent in the bill and from Duncan Wise, who, as he noted and you noted, serves also on the commission, a sense of the commission's readiness to take up this topic as well as others in the kind of in the spectrum of ideas that relate to this huge challenge around affordability. The Commission's moving forward with a strategic plan that we hope to present in some form to you later this month that pulls affordability out as a, you know, as its own plank in a sort of four-part plan. And this bill clearly presents one of, you know, several options for tackling that, and we're eager to get to work.
Thank you. And we would like to be involved to the extent that the interim committees will still be coming down here while you're working on this, and we can post updates and attend hearings and whatnot.
Very good. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, we're in work session. Senator Cannella, would you like to make a motion?
Chair Hess, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated February 4, 2014.
Senator Knoop moves the Dash 1s to Senate Bill 1524. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, the amendment is ordered, and thank you, Senator Knoop, for getting on that.
You're welcome. Chair Hess, I move Senate Bill 1524 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knoop moves Senate Bill 1524 to the floor of the Oregon State House as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Excuse me, you should move it to the floor of the Senate, not the House.
The floor, did I say House?
Yes.
He did.
My goodness. First day. Senator Knoop moves Senate Bill 1524 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate.
There we go.
With a due pass recommendation, is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, I will carry that bill along with others, and I appreciate your help with this and your engagement. It's been almost a year since we've been talking about it, and I think we've got something to start molding. So I will close our work session on Senate Bill 1524 and open up a public hearing and work session on SCR 204. Senator Hansel is here. Administrator Donovan, would you give us a quick summary?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Concurrent Resolution 204 honors Major General Raymond F. Reese for his distinguished career and service to his state and country. Major General Reese was an incredibly highly decorated Oregonian and member of the Armed Services, and I will let Senator Hansel elaborate upon that.
Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Senator Hess, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, Senator in District 29. I appreciate the opportunity to facilitate this. Normally, it would be a much longer procedure, but General Reese, in his retirement, is moving back for a period of time to the Pentagon, and he leaves on Thursday. So in order to have him present here for this memorial that was originally slated for us to consider it in the long session, due to some personnel issues within his department, it got lost in the shuffle, and by the time I realized it was too late in the session, so we moved it forward and have been working on it since that time. And if it meets with your approval, we will take it before the floor tomorrow. This was the first committee that was meeting that we could bring it to, and appreciate your accommodation. General Reese and I grew up in neighboring rural farm communities. We played basketball against each other. We were in speech contests together. And we've kind of maintained our friendship through the years. He's an Oregonian that has served the state meritoriously and the nation in his various military career, and also locally and various the hospital boards and other things that he served on in between some of these deployments. So I won't take up a lot of time. Be happy to answer any questions. But this is the concurrent resolution, the memorial for his service to the state of Oregon.
And you guys knew each other for how long?
Well, he graduated in 62 and I graduated in 63, so over 50 years. So.
And he was here in the National Guard up until?
This summer.
He had kind of and he's going to be going on to a new adventure to the Pentagon.
This is a civilian job. He has retired from the military. It's a short duration. He told me what it was, but the handle is fairly lengthy as to undersecretary, da-da-da-da-da. But it was an opportunity for him to continue to serve. He's been back in Helix for about 6 months. Maybe got a little bored. I'm not sure, but you can do that in Helix pretty easy. But
in Helix?
And he had this opportunity to serve. And he is in a civilian position, not in the military, but kind of in his retirement, giving back to the country.
Well, Washington, D.C. is about as far away from Helix as you can possibly.
Well, when he went away to college at West Point, that was equally far away as you can get, pretty much. And interestingly, another young man from Helix has been accepted for West Point this year. So that community has provided leadership in this way, and we're pretty proud of him.
Any other questions or comments?
Great. Well, it's nice that you're doing this. We're in a work session, Senator Knope.
Chair Hass, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 204 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Concurrent Resolution 204 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, Senate Concurrent Resolution 204 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Hansel will be the carrier.
I would be honored.
And we are closing this work session. Please do your homework for the Thursday omnibus bill that we hope to move out of committee. There's four or five technical provisions here. We'll talk about it some more. And if there's no other business before us, we are adjourned. You're adjourned.